Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian Insight Podcast. This is number 235, recording this on Thursday, the 28th of March, 2013. It's been about 2 weeks since our last podcast. I have with me Mr. Rafe Blandford.
Hello, everybody.
And yes, sir, there's quite a few stories to talk about. We always seem to find something, Rafe. I know we're in Symbian's twilight years, but hey-ho, there's still apps appearing. There are still updates appearing, and we'll go over a few of those in this podcast. First of all, Nokia has released an update uploader to SkyDrive. This is the same thing that happened for Bell Refresh and Bell Feature Pack 2. The same utility has now been rolled out or backported to certain S65th edition devices. So basically you get your photos you take uploaded to SkyDrive, and your contacts are rather slowly, but they are processed and uploaded to the SkyDrive contact section, with the idea, I guess, being that Nokia want a few of these Nokia 5530, 5230, 5800 owners. There's quite a few of those out there that possibly just think about, okay, now, guys, now's the time to move over to a Windows Phone-powered Lumia device, and having all your stuff uploaded automatically means you just get synced automatically down to your Lumia. So, Rafe, I guess the question is, this is quite a limited selection of S65th edition devices, but it's a step in the right direction. I just doubt whether that many people will actually take advantage of it.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, of course. I mean, some of the devices here are amongst the best-selling of the Symbian devices, so there's potentially a really big addressable market, you know, that's lots of people bought these devices, but, you know, how many will actually be aware of this and go and download it? Having said that, it's in beta, and, you know, the reason, obviously, for that is some of the limitations on these devices. Effectively, you're more likely to run up against it when running these kind of things, you know, particularly when sorting all through the data on the device. But still, as you say, it's good to see this because I actually think with some of the upcoming Windows Phone devices, you know, particularly the 520 and the Lumia 620, you know, they're both relatively low-cost devices. So the sort of person who might well have some of these S65th edition devices, you know, that may be the sort of device they're looking at upgrading to. And honestly, I think if they do so, they'll find that you know, Windows Phone is a very positive experience, you know, moving from that type of device up to a Windows Phone 8 device, simply because there's, you know, a big gap in the kind of the features. Now, that's not to say you won't find some things missing. We've talked about that before, and the kind of customizability of Symbian, or, you know, the geekiness, you know, being able to fiddle with it. But I suspect a lot of people on those devices aren't doing that kind of thing. I also suspect they're probably not listening to this podcast, although if you are, I do apologize. I think you've been very loyal to the devices, but getting the content off is obviously a big deal, because if you've got a device that long, the chances are you've got a lot of valuable content on it that you want to keep, and this is, you know, one way to do it. And it's not just moving to Windows Phone. You can also use this if you're going to Android or potentially another platform or a feature phone or something like that. Getting it back down onto those other devices might not be quite so easy, but you know, if nothing else, getting it off the device, kind of archiving it in a cloud storage service somewhere, is going to be a good thing.
Yeah, I guess the Symbian family would just take issues with one of your phrases there. You said a gap in features, implying that the Windows Phone devices have more features. I would actually argue quite significantly that the S65th edition devices have a lot more features than the Windows Phone 8 devices. It's just that the user interface is 100 times better on the Windows Phone 8 in terms of fluidity and speed and responsiveness. That's the real gap for me. The sheer number of features in Symbian all through the ages has been head and shoulders above all the other mobile operating systems, I say.
Yeah, well, actually, when I was talking about that, I meant there are features missing from Windows Phone. If I wasn't clear, I apologise.
Okay.
Because I think if you draw up a list feature by feature, you're probably right. You will get a longer list from Symbian. You know, for example, it's things like the VoIP calling. That's just starting to come into Windows Phone now, but it does really require the third-party application to kind of do a specific app for each service. You can't, you know, it's those kind of integral settings that you got in Symbian, and if you use them, you know, you find them invaluable. The number of people using some of those features is probably pretty low, but as you say, you do kind of have to set it against the overall user experience when you've got a slicker UI, or maybe better performing. I mean, it depends on your point of view, I guess, whether you regard it as slicker or not. But I think most people will go to Windows Phone, and, you know, it's a more modern smartphone operating system. You know, they're going to probably find it better. As I say, you might find something that's missing. And of course, there's all sorts of things that Windows Phone can do that the older Symbian devices in particular can't do. You know, I think, you know, for me, one of the not revelations, you know, when I switch back to an older Symbian device, is how frustrating it is to kind of use the email and the web experience when you're used to, you know, something a bit slicker or smoother. And it's interesting, it's, you know, it's not about the feature, because of course you can still go and visit those sites, but it's about the speed with which the page loads, how quickly you can move around it. And with something like the email, you know, it's more about, you know, being able to deal with a large volume of email relatively quickly, then do quick replies. As I say, it's not that you can't do it. It's about, you know, how comfortable I am doing it. And, you know, I do notice, you know, I tend to use the Symbian devices for specific things. You know, for example, the 808, great for taking pictures, and I do use it for that and continue to do so. And I will make, you know, phone calls and send the odd text message on it. But it's almost got to the point where I do tend to carry the Windows Phone device as well, except in rare circumstances when it's, you know, I'm not going to really need a phone. And if you told me that, you know, a couple of years ago, I'd have probably been a bit surprised the switch over had been quite so total. But it's worth sharing that experience, I think, with the listeners to this podcast, because I know there's a lot of people go, I never want to switch, but I think you have to keep an open mind.
Yeah, sure. And I know you've probably still got your E6 somewhere in a back pocket just for those, you know, when you're out and about doing true road warrior stuff, you want a battery that will last for 2 days.
Absolutely. I was actually in Wales and doing some walking. I took that with me simply because I knew I could rely on it to last all day. It wouldn't be a problem. And indeed, you know, it was borne out by the experience. You know, I forgot to charge the Windows Phone device, so that was kind of dead halfway through the second day. And the E6 was still tracking along sort of 4 days later. You know, I didn't even bother to recharge it because, you know, I wasn't using it intensively or anything. And, you know, it's interesting, that battery life thing is still something that's important for me personally. And you can take recharges along. And obviously, it depends on your pattern of use. If you're sitting in an office all day, I'm not sure you ever notice it. But there's definitely still, for me, a really strong desire to have a smartphone that will last through a couple of days. But it's fair to say, I mean, you look at all the market research on this, and it's fair to say that most people say if it lasts a day, that's fine as far as they're concerned. And most people will even say, you know, if you're doing something intensively on it, you know, watching video, I realise it's not going to last. And it's interesting, I do think there's been a shift in expectations. You know, when Symbian first came along, you know, one of the really big things was, you know, which Symbian majored on all the way through its life, was making sure it wasn't power intensive, you know, doing really careful power management, because, you know, the idea of a phone not lasting 3 or 4 days was an anathema. And of course now you come to the day and, oh great, it lasted through a day. And so part of me screamed and goes, what does it mean it's only lasting a day? But I guess that's a shift in, you know, user expectations and behavior, because as I said, a lot of people maybe sit in an office or are close to a charger, and I guess as they become more critical and people do more things with them, you know, the amount of dissatisfaction or annoyance people are willing to put up with in order to keep using the smartphone maybe it's increased, so they're more willing to, you know, plug into a charger more frequently. You know, it'll be an interesting study to look at in more detail.
I just think they're not the out and about types like we are, Rafe, out in the fresh air, liaising with nature, etc.
Well, maybe.
Now, also, of course, in addition to the uploader, it's worth noting that most average users will probably just plug in their 5800 or 5230 into their Windows PC, as they've done since time immemorial, and notice the fact that Nokia Suite keeps prompting updates, and the latest updates do actually do the syncing of the contacts and the uploading of photos to SkyDrive as part of Nokia Suite functionality. So, as you say, I don't think a huge number of users actually are going to seek out this Beta Labs uploader and install it. I think that 99.9% of these older S60 5th edition users will actually use the Nokia Suite and achieve the same ends, which is absolutely fine.
And it's probably also worth saying, on the Windows Phone devices, at least Nokia's ones, there's sort of contact share or contact transfer, rather, that allows you to bring across your contact data, which I suspect for most people will be, you know, the single most valuable thing on their device. And they'll probably maybe retain the old devices for maybe, you know, text messages that they're attached to for some reason. And of course, the photos you can copy and paste via a PC or even send across via email, the ones that are really important to you. But nonetheless, it's kind of good to see that Nokia hasn't forgotten this idea that people may want to move from one device to another. I think it's something that often gets missed out when, you know, people talk about smartphones, because often that, you know, that data is valuable. It's not necessarily even the value, it's kind of the inconvenience of having to recreate it on another device. And I know I've certainly experienced this when moving between platforms, which is, you know, one of my major drivers for kind of having all my contact data sitting in the cloud, and actually sits in a couple of different places, and depending on what device I'm using, you know, I'll sync it back and forth. It's been in Google Contacts via mail for Exchange for a long time, but I recently moved it over to Outlook.com because I wanted to keep using mail, Microsoft Exchange, simply because it seemed to be the most universal thing between all platforms. If people were asking my advice, I'd say that's what you should look at doing.
Yeah. Also updated, and this is a genuine live update appearing for all Bell Refresh phones, is a quote fix for messaging, offering critical fixes to known messaging issues. We don't actually know what these are. I have heard anecdotally people having SMS issues with messages stuck in outboxes and so forth. It's only a 312 kilobyte update, installs in seconds. It should appear in SW update or software update on your device. Just go look for that and install it. And doubtless it will it appear transparent to you, but it may well fix a problem. Yes, Rafe, it's good to see. Yes, sir. A core component being updated in the current Symbian platform for the N87, C7, and so forth, even in 2013.
Yeah, we talked about this in the last podcast, and I sort of said, I don't know how many more updates there'll be, and I'm proved wrong in the very next podcast. I suspect we'll keep seeing these as bug fixes. In this case, as you say, it's probably related to the failed sending of messages. It may well also be to do with the kind of the character encoding of text messages. This is actually a problem that you see on quite a few platforms in specific markets. If text messages not encoded in quite the right way, you can get failures, or they don't arrive at the person. And so implementing updates like this means you sort of get the smooth experience. As you say, I suspect most people won't notice the difference, but of course I'm sure there's someone out there going, oh, finally it's fixed the problem I'm having, and I can receive and get them and send the text messages that I want to. And I suspect a lot of this, what will be happening is a bug report will come into Nokia, usually the Nokia care teams. That can be online or country specific, and then it gets sort of fed backwards. And once it gets to kind of a critical level, it will get investigated, and then the fix will get created, then it will get rolled out via SW update. And honestly, I'm pretty impressed with the support that is continuing for these Symbian devices. Previously these updates would have probably only come out with firmware updates and would have never really known about them because they were integrated into a firmware update, and they'd have just come under the kind of general category of performance and stability improvements. But because we're seeing them specifically come out one at a time rather than in firmware updates, we kind of get this impression that there's more going on. As I said, I think it's actually more to do with the delivery mechanism than the activity level.
Yeah, it does show that there are still people awake over there at Accenture, though, of course, so, which is
great. And because there's lots of people still using these devices, it depends on the estimate. The Steve Littrell TM estimate suggests at least 100 million active Symbian devices out there, and it could well be more than that. And when you consider, that some of its competitors are not really near that, BlackBerry 10 or Windows Phone, depending on the numbers you look at, Windows Phone is probably now maybe 20 plus million. And obviously, BlackBerry 10's only just come out, so it's a few million. So, people talk about what's the hot device and what's popular, but you do need to remember that these things kind of have a time lag, and the install base doesn't always reflect what's being talked about in the media.
Yeah, you said to some of the tech journalists that there are 50 times more active Symbian users in the world than BlackBerry 10 users. They'd think, no, that can't be right, but it is right, and it will remain right for some time to come. Also updated, maps we talked about before in a previous podcast, the baseline street maps were updated across all of Nokia's mapping platforms, and Nokia's Symbian users inherited those updates. We've now also, I noticed and posted a short story, that the Nokia public transport databases were updated at Nokia's end on their servers, and provided you're running the Nokia Beta Labs version 2.5 release of the app, Nokia Public Transport, then you can actually see all of that information and use the bus timetables and arrival times and so forth, which is, again, good to see, Rafe.
It is, and we actually talked about this when we talked about Nokia Public Transport in beta. One of the things that came out was this ability to update the kind of cities covered or the areas covered without the need for an app update. And what's happening is it's effectively going up to the server and saying, can I have an updated configuration or a data file that says, oh, here you go, and it comes back with a list of cities and can therefore start querying them. Again, this is something like the maps database that is kind of common between all of Nokia's platforms, and I noticed that public transport's just become available for the Azure Full Touch, that's the Series 40 devices, and obviously it's also available on Windows Phone in the form of Here Transit. And actually, I think this public transport information is one of the hidden gems on, you know, Nokia's devices, because it provides really helpful information. You know, it's obviously, it depends whether your location is covered, but now there's an increasing number of places. You know, the UK just increased the number of cities covered by 50 or so, for example. And a lot of the time, it's got real-time information, so it'll, you know, be able to tell you not just when it's scheduled to arrive, but, you know, what that live progress on the bus is, and so you can know when to go to the bus stop within a few minutes. It's just a little thing, but I think it's a great example of how a smartphone can just make life a little bit easier. You know, before, you'd go and wait in a cold bus stop for 10 minutes, and now you can just spend that extra 5 minutes in the warm, which at this time of year in the UK, it's very helpful, especially as we're having a cold snap. But also, more than that, I think it's actually the great thing is when you're in an unfamiliar city, or when you're travelling somewhere that you don't know very well, try and work out which buses go where can be really tricky. And just putting it into this application and relying on Nokia Transit, you kind of have to trust it. But I've done so several times in both in the UK and also other countries, and it works brilliantly well. I will say that on occasion, it's not quite as reliable as looking at the transport maps and working out for yourself which is the quickest route. It sometimes takes a slightly weird routing, and I suspect that's to do with the information that it's being fed. And, you know, sometimes it'll make you change buses when actually you're better off staying on the bus and walking 5 minutes at the end. But that's, you know, being very picky, and versus not knowing where the buses are going at all. It's great. And so, yes, as you say, getting this data update is really nice as well, because it's just making it available, or rather useful, for more people. So definitely worth keeping an eye on. And so especially if you're listening to this podcast in the UK, the recent update added a lot of UK cities, you know, particularly regional ones, which weren't covered before.
Including Reading, my hometown, Woo-hoo. Which I was very pleased to see, and also Slough, which is nearby, and David, of course, we'll have seen a month or so ago, they added Hull, so yeah, we're all sorted.
Yes, and I got local buses as well. Unfortunately, the nearest bus stop's 2 miles away, and there's only one bus a week, but still, some progress.
But you do live in the middle of nowhere, Rafe.
Yeah, well, that's the problem.
One application update I just wanted to highlight. This is a third-party app called Slide to Unlock, and the reason I wanted to highlight it is it claims to offer Nokia N9 iMeego style double tap unlocking. So just to refresh people's memory, the N9 shows an always on AMOLED clock, just like most of the Symbian devices. But on the N9, rather than have to press a button, you can literally just double tap the screen and it will spring to life. And this Symbian app, Slide to Unlock, which is currently free in the Nokia store by LanternSoft, claims to offer almost identical functionality. In fact, it's slightly different. Now, there's two ways of getting into your smartphone with Slide to Unlock. One is to use two fingers and basically drag them sort of MacBook trackpad style across the screen, and that unlocks it, which is very, very intuitive and also nice, left to right. Or the double tap works. You put one finger on the screen, making contact with it, and then double tap with another finger, which sounds a bit convoluted. I don't know why they can't just do it with a single double tap. But anyway, it works, and so you've got two different ways of getting into your Symbian smartphone without having to touch the home physical button or a side toggle switch. And I think that's pretty convenient, Rafe.
Yeah, this was a feature I really, really liked on the N9. I can remember at the launch, a whole bunch of us were just looking at the device, double tapping it, and then locking it again, double tapping it again. It's one of those intuitive features. You don't really think about it until you've tried it. I think it's a shame it doesn't work quite the same way, because it is a bit fiddly, frankly, having a double touch. But the reason for that, obviously, is it's actually detecting a multi-touch event, and I suspect it can't quite manage a double touch from a completely sleeping screen, and kind of the first touch wakes up a little bit enough to be able to then be responsive to the subsequent double touch. But as you say, actually some kind of screen interaction to unlock a device rather than having to go via the slider key. Personally, I actually do like having a slider key. It's one of the things I miss on the Windows Phone devices. You just have a lock key rather than the slider. And I always like that, I guess, because that was used on the E6 and quite a few other devices, where it kind of became almost a standard thing. The N8 was another device, you know, high profile one that had it. But also a lot of the cheaper 65th edition devices, like the 5230. I think it maybe was the 5800 was one of the first to have it, of those touchscreen devices anyway. So yeah, nice to have, and I don't know, there's just something quite elegant about it. It's one of those things you start using, you go, just brings a sense of satisfaction. And so I was interested to note, try not to mention Windows Phone too much on the Symbian podcast, but I suspect people might like to know this is actually something that's, you know, being expected to be added in a firmware update to Nokia's Windows Phone 8 devices in the next few weeks or so. It's just come out in the States. That's another firmware update, but it is expected to be added kind of in a future update in a few months' time. But it's a good indication of some of these features that Nokia have had on old devices, be it Migo or Symbian, are only now being added to the Windows Phone devices. So that kind of, you know, the experience of Nokia, the maturity of some of the features, it's still kind of being brought up to date on the Windows Phone device. And I think that's quite telling in a way.
You heard it here first. Windows Phone is years behind. No. Okay, there. Moving on. Also, another third-party app I wanted to highlight. This is Burst Camera from Harold Meyer, one of my favorite developers. And basically, we talked in previous podcasts, also the Windows Phone one, about Rafe's experiences with devices like the HTC One running Android, which I believe he now has as a review device, which the Zoe mode, whereby it's like a burst mode built into the hardware. So you, rather than taking single photos, you take bursts of photos, and you can then pick just the one with the right expression, which is really handy. I loved it when I reviewed that for my phone show, the HTC One. And a burst camera on Symbian almost does the same kind of thing. You basically set it up to, for example, you can pick the number of shots you want per second, say 4 or 5 per second, and you can pick the duration of the burst, and you then point it at your subject, you know, a toddler or a baby taking their first steps, and you press the shutter icon, and it starts the burst mode. It's about a 20-second processing time, which is a bit of a shame, but it's all been done in software rather than on hardware, as on HTC One, so you can kind of understand that. But at the end of the day, you get a burst of 20 or 30 2 megapixel images, and you can pick just the one you want and then save that to your gallery. So it's not quite as good as the HTC One, Rafe, but this burst camera is only about £1.50 or so, and it's a really useful facility if, as my case, you know, you're quite often shooting family and friends with small children who never stay still, and you have to capture just the right expression, and that's the perfect shot, and it's difficult to do with just one shot.
That's right. It's interesting. You know, I can remember burst mode was initially kind of about capturing interesting fast-moving events, someone running or sports or something like that. But with the smartphones, it increasingly came about kind of capturing the perfect shot. And, you know, HTC are far from the first to kind of do this concept with Zoe and obviously this burst mode. And it's kind of the perfect picture. It's something that Sony Ericsson did very early on their devices. But I do think this implementation is pretty slick, and it's impressive that it can be, you know, so smooth on hardware that frankly is, you know, several generations now out of date compared to a lot of the, you know, leading smartphones. I mean, this is being done on relatively low speed processing and RAM, and I think is a testament to the skill of the developer, really. I will say that, you know, with HTC's implementation of Zoe, it's a lot of it's also about how it's presented to the user, and I think that's a lot slicker. And there's, you know, a couple of things to talk about there, in that it's kind of an integrated mode in the default camera app, and so instead of taking a video or a still, you take what they call a Zoe, and it does this burst mode automatically. It then saves all the pictures automatically without you thinking about it. As you say, there's no processing. You know, that's, you know, forgivable given the kind of the hardware that it's running on, but it then also presents them in a decent way, and the gallery actually shows a 3-second video clip that's taken at the same time and the burst mode is captured. None of that's should be taken against this app, which I think is really nice, but it does kind of remind me that for all of these camera experiences, it's just as much about how you present it to the user, the user interface. And actually, I think you could read that as a general story of Symbian, you know, really very capable from a technical point of view, but let down a little bit by the user interface, the user experience, which is why you kind of still get people talking about Symbian being hard to use, old, out of date, old fashioned. And, you know, it's not very good. And you think, actually, there's nothing wrong with the underlying stuff. It was the kind of the UI that seemed to let it down. And obviously, there's been lots of improvements with Bell and, you know, the subsequent updates to that as well. But even so, if you're kind of a camera nut, if you're on an 808 or an N8, I think this app's really worth downloading, as is all of actually Harold Meyer's stuff. He's, you know, really taken these camera-centric devices and added an extra layer of functionality. You know, it's not for everybody, obviously, but I think if you're on one of those devices, a lot of the reasons for being so will be because you like the good camera. And this just enables you to get a little bit more out of it. So it's the kind of latest addition to his app lineup.
Yeah. And I remember the reason I wanted to highlight it in this particular podcast is that the new version 1.0.3 includes, as suggested by me, the ability to keep the video, the burst video. So basically, rather than shooting individual shots at whatever you choose, 10 frames, 10 shots a second, which is not physically possible at 2 megapixel, basically his application shoots a 1080p HD video for that burst duration. And then the processing splices up that video into the 2 megapixel stills. And with this new version, you get to keep the video as well. Just like on the HTC Zoe, where in the gallery, you see the video as well as the photos potentially. Again, if you take the option in this version of burst camera and then go into your gallery, you'll see there's the 3-second video as well as the photos you've decided to save. So it's not quite as slick. Well, it's nowhere near as slick as on the HTC One, but the idea is there and you can do it.
I hadn't seen the new, obviously you need to update the version of this that's on my 808 to get the video as well, because I mean it's a clever trick how this has been implemented, and actually that's kind of the secret for how it's able to do it on the hardware, kind of as Steve put it in the post about this deconstructing the video, kind of extracting the frame. It is probably fair to say that using that method isn't as good as taking an individual picture each time, because obviously you're kind of dependent on the video settings, and you know, that tends to be optimized to something slightly different than still pictures. But actually the results, if you try out this app, I think are pretty promising, and you know, certainly for stuff that you wouldn't otherwise get a decent picture of, definitely worth using. I mean, going back to the user experience, of course, the problem with this is you kind of have to make a conscious decision to use it, and that doesn't always, you know, tie in with the way people typically use cameras. You know, usually it's, oh, quick, press the shutter button, get things going. Oh, whoops, I should have used burst mode. But that's being very picky and a little unfair.
Yeah. I should apologise really for the wealth of guinea pigs on our various sites over the last few days. But it's very, very hard. All my real world shots are of toddlers and family and friends, and it completely invades their privacy if I then put those photos up on an international site. So I tend to restrict it.
That's right. That's why I always take pictures of the cat and various wildlife around the house and the garden. So yes, if people wonder about that, it's not that Steve's obsessed with his guinea pigs. I mean, obviously he cares for them deeply, but they don't demand any image rights or appearance fees.
Well, your cat has sometimes.
Well, it has to buy the nice quality cat food, not any of that supermarket own brand stuff. Otherwise it turns its nose up at it and refuses to talk to me for the next week.
One final third-party app I just wanted to mention, purely because it's just genuinely innovative and astonishing, is that a game called N-Chess. Now, it's not actually that good a chess game, but I don't know whether you saw this, Rafe. It's a complete chess game and artificial intelligence engine. You can play against the AI of your computer, of your smartphone, at 4 different difficulty levels, and it's all implemented in web runtimes. In other words, it's a JavaScript chess game implemented or packaged within web runtime and runs kind of as a mini web page on your phone as an app. And the whole concept of that this could be possible kind of blew my mind.
Yeah, it's interesting. This kind of ties in, I guess, to the native versus web app debate, which has been ongoing. Of course, the real answer to that is you choose whatever's best for the circumstances, and they coexist alongside each other. But I can remember being impressed by a checkers game that was implemented in web runtime in the same way. And obviously, this is another level of difficulty beyond that. As you say, you know, the engine in this isn't very smart. I was actually able to beat it, which since I haven't played chess for quite some time, I was feeling suitably impressed, but I suspect if the difficulty level went up, it would soon be beating me. But as you say, you know, the fact you can do this all with JavaScript and web technologies, and then, you know, have it running on a phone in a way that's, you know, the performance is pretty decent, is hugely impressive. But I think for those of us who've been around long enough to remember sort of HTML, where JavaScript was this newfangled thing that, you know, was maybe animating the odd bit of text or doing an odd bit of calculation, and you could say, oh, look, if you type in my name to this dialogue box, the page will greet me going, hello, Rafe. You know, it's obviously come on a long way since then. There's lots of libraries. So this stuff isn't, in one sense, that difficult to implement, because, of course, all these algorithms are relatively well known. But still, there is this kind of sense, if you understand what's going on under the hood, I was impressed too.
Yeah. One final thing before we finish. I did one of my famous patented camera shootouts. This was the Nokia 808, the HTC One we just mentioned, with its what they call ultra pixels. So it's basically a lower number of megapixels on the same size sensor. giving you, in theory, lower digital noise. And the Nokia Lumia 920 running Windows Phone, and the Imposter. In my case, I was throwing it against the N95 from 2007, also with a 5-megapixel camera, the same resolution. I was running all of these devices in either 4, 5, or 7 megapixel resolution, so it was pretty much an apples-to-apples comparison. I did about 6 or 7 test shots, and my end results, unsurprisingly, now Rafe may want to defend the phone in fourth place here, but the end results, Nokia 808 PureView was way out in front, and I don't think anyone will be surprised at that. You can see the article for the full crops, but it's just astonishing how natural some of the 808's photographs are. It's just incredible. The HTC One came in second place, narrowly beating the N95. There really wasn't much to choose between them, and I guess you could say, well, how can that be that a device that's 6 years older, the N95, can be more or less equal with a device from 2013. I guess that just shows just how good Nokia's cameras were back in the day. I still think the N95 camera hardware is underrated. It was used in the N95 8GB, obviously, the N96, the N97, and various other phones, all of which inherited this really very, very good camera and constantly underrated. When Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone, he said, well, the iPhone is 5 years ahead of the competition. He was talking about specific aspects. I was equally pointing out, well, come on, some aspects of Symbian hardware running under Nokia's guys are 5 years ahead of the competition too. And I think the N95 proves that here by equaling the HTC One score. And in fourth place, I have to say, the Nokia Lumia 920 running Windows Phone, which is a not a dismal last, but it was disappointing. And my gut feel, Rafe, and I know this is the All About Symbian podcast, but the 808 just had its moment in the sun, glory. But my gut feel with the 920, which I really wanted to do better than it actually did, is that Nokia still need to fix elements of the software. There's still something not quite right in the way the images are processed. I still think it could do better. It should be up with the HTC One, at least.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, with these shootouts, obviously, we're talking about kind of raw camera performance, and it's fair to say that on a lot of these comparisons, you'll only notice a difference if you kind of crop right in, which is what Steve always does on these comparisons. And so when we talk about these point differences, it suggests a big difference, but actually they're all pretty capable as camera phones. And I guess I should provide some defense for the 920, but actually it kind of is borne out by my experience. I mean, I know the interesting thing about this, of course, is it depends on what you're taking a picture of. And if you look at the actual results of this particular one, you'll notice that each camera performs well in some areas and wins one category or the other. The 808 is typically always the best, but the other devices do typically swap about a little bit, and actually sometimes the 808 is defeated by one of the other devices, and it can be because it's optimized for a particular algorithm. Yeah, it will vary, but you're right, I do think there's room for improvement on the Lumia 920. There's actually a firmware update going out right now, which again tweaks the camera settings. We'll do another kind of comparison shootout if we can, to look at that. I wouldn't expect it to make a vast difference, but kind of the interesting thing is, I think, with the N95 is, although we talk about how quickly smartphone technology has moved on, actually in the case of the camera, that's not quite so true in terms of at least this raw output. I mean, in all fairness, you can do more with the images now, and it was actually always one of the frustrations with the N95 was it was producing great shots, but then getting them off the phone and doing interesting things with them wasn't that easy. I mean, there were various things I can remember, printing over Bluetooth, for example, and being impressed by that. That's something that's pretty much gone away as sharing onto the web, on social networks, became much more of a thing to do with your photos. I mean, interesting one there. And there's plenty of other examples of that. The thing to realize, though, is there have been changes to the camera modules themselves. And you'll notice this if you take apart your devices, which obviously we're not going to do and can't do on an audio podcast. But believe me when I say the actual camera module in the N95 is quite chunky. I mean, think of maybe your little fingernail, and it's kind of that size in terms of, it's actually obviously a cube. I don't think it's quite a centimeter by a centimeter, but it's certainly maybe 3/4 centimeter by 3/4 centimeter. The actual module in the 920 is significantly smaller, and that will also apply to the 1X. The 808's slightly different in that actually the module isn't all that different in size, but of course there's a much bigger sensor in there. It's doing a lot more. And so what's actually happened over the years is the camera modules have miniaturized but maintained a similar level of performance. Now, obviously, you go, well, why not kind of keep them the same size and, you know, have better performance. Well, it's probably because the performance for most people is good enough, and actually there was more pressure to reduce the size of the camera modules, and that's because it means you can create thinner devices, because the camera module is often one of the thickest components in the device. So that's why the N95, I can remember it first coming out and thinking, being quite impressed by the relatively slim dimensions. You look at it now and, okay, it's a slider device, so that gives it some leeway, but actually it's relatively chunky in the hand compared to a modern smartphone. And actually what we've had instead, if they've kind of got wider and longer, is the emphasis to having a big screen has come, but they're all quite, you know, they're not fat anymore, smartphones. They're actually quite thin, and that trend's continued. Talked a bit about whether that's a good thing or not on the podcast before, but a lot of that is actually down to the camera module. So I thought this was a really interesting shootout, just to see, you know, I thought I'd give a bit of the story behind the camera module there to try and give an extra bit of insight to live up to the name of the podcast. But yeah, it was interesting results. I think you were maybe a little unfair on the 920, just because of the way this particular test was done. So we talk, it is about raw results, and it depends on what you're shooting. But having said that, it's not that far away from my experience. The one thing we did then talk about subsequently, Steve was taking these shots by pressing the camera capture button on all the devices, apart from the One X, obviously. Not the One X, the One, obviously. Yeah. And one of the things we did talk a little bit about with the 920 was it wasn't always seeming to be focusing properly in some of the lower light situations. And she speculated, and we haven't got a definitive answer on this yet, whether that was because it was kind of getting kind of 95% focused and then taking the picture because it didn't want to take too long between pressing the shutter and capturing you know, the photo. And obviously that's about how good the user experience is. And actually is another dimension that isn't directly mentioned in this test, but is kind of the how much time does it take from pressing the shutter to getting the shot. And actually that's right. Something that's worth talking about in the context of these cameras, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah, the N95. I mean, I was shocked when I first had the N95 back in 2007. You'd line up your shot, you'd press the shutter key half down, and it would focus in about 1 or 2 seconds. You think, well, that's fine. I've now got the focus. Now I'll take the photograph, and then it'd take the photograph. Then it would sit there processing for 4 or 5 seconds. Then it would finally appear. The whole shot-to-shot time was around 10 seconds, but that seemed normal back in 2007. And I was horrified going back to the N95 after using modern devices. The 808, it focuses in 1/5 of a second sometimes, and it then saves some of the 5-megapixel image in another half a second. And the shot-to-shot time can be as short as 1 second. 10 times faster than the N95. The HTC One is, I guess, even faster. The Lumia 920 is not far behind. So, yeah, that's one area which you really, really notice when you go back to the old phones.
And it's interesting. You don't think about that when looking at these results, obviously. But I actually think that user experience of the camera is really, really important, because obviously it's how quickly you can capture, particularly with, you know, happy snaps or casual style photos. A lot of the time you're in a time limit, you want to capture something quickly and move on. And, you know, it always used to be you're taking it, oh, just wait, I've got to frame this properly, get it all right. And it would take a while, and you'd want to take a second shot with the end. After talking to Steve about this, I went back and tried it myself. And yeah, it was quite horrifying in a way, but it's these things that you forget about. And so, you know, progress can happen in more than one way. And obviously the reason for this is partly about the camera modules themselves. They've got more sophisticated, and so that focusing time does come down. Also, it's obviously the software on board. It's got smarter about how it does that. And to a certain extent, it's also a processor and memory limitation. Although actually more of this is all mainly happening in kind of the camera stack, which is composed of the lens, the sensor, and the image processing. And there's both the sensor and the chips involved in that. Most of that all happens in there rather than being fed into the main processor. So it's not really about the fact we've now got dual core. It's just about the increasing sophistication of these camera modules. So when Steve starts harping on about how brilliant things used to be, I'm just going to remind him that sometimes progress does happen, just not quite in the way you might expect.
Yeah. But at least Symbian users can take solace from the fact that the 808 did win by a huge margin. I did see one blog entry from one of the various blogs talking about superlatives and saying, just think of some superlatives generally. Think of some adjectives for gaps and chasms and the distance by which the 808 might be superior to every other phone camera out there, and all of them will be true. And I think that's probably true. The 808, it's got a these physics at the end of the day will win. The N95 does so well despite its speed, because it has a large sensor for the day, 1 over 2.5 optical format. The 808 has an enormous sensor. It's a camera sensor that's getting up towards the same sort of size you talk about with really good standalone cameras. So it really isn't surprising that it keeps running away with these tests, and everyone's still looking forward to something, perhaps running Windows Phone from Nokia coming sometime this year, which implements most of the 808's technology in something which is really, really modern and future-proof. I guess, 30 seconds, Rafe, will that happen?
Yes, I do think it will happen. It's just a matter of time. I would probably put it more towards the end of the year than the middle of the year, but we'll have to wait and see. But you're right about the 808. It really can't be put in the same category. I mean, actually, people compare it to the Android power cameras, like the Galaxy camera that Samsung produced. That's actually, you know, a fair comparison. The 808 manages to beat that, despite being, you know, a smaller unit. And you can't really have too many superlatives about it. And it is unusual. I mean, you think about the smartphone world, it's very rare to have a device that's so far ahead in one area that, you know, it belongs in a different category. These days, you know, hardware is very similar between the devices, and we've talked about that before. You know, software has become more important. But it is one area where I think Nokia need to continue to exploit their advantage. It's something they did quite well in the Symbian world. They're always known for their great hardware. The first generation of their Windows Phone devices didn't really live up to that promise. The design was there. I don't think the overall hardware, it's got better with Windows Phone 8. And you can talk about optical image stabilization in the 920, for example, or, you know, the super sensitive screen or other bits of it. But there's still a lot of potential there. And I think the imaging one is a great area to look at. I mean, just thinking about imaging still, the 720, which is Nokia's new Lumia device, it's kind of mid-range. Think of it as maybe the equivalent of the C7 or the 701. And, you know, Steve and I had many debates over the EDOF camera in that particular device, and they've actually done something interesting with the camera in the 720. You know, it's got a very low F number. It's, you know, the optical format size isn't great, but it produces some really astonishing results, mainly because of that low F number, but also because there's been some really interesting optimizations in it. There's some advanced stuff in the lenses as well, on the front camera as well as the rear camera. And it's actually produced a camera that I think is out of its class for a mid-range device. You know, it's not quite as good as the high-end stuff, but it gets close. And I think more innovation like that all through the range is a good thing, even if, you know, it's always going to be devices like the 808 that kind of take most of the attention. An 808 camera model on a Windows Phone device, I think, might be the thing that makes Steve switch over as his primary device, actually. I think secretly he may have already done that some of the time, but he's not going to admit that on this podcast, obviously.
Of course not. And one final plug is I did write a short piece on how to make jaws drop with the Nokia 808. And I don't know if people remember that famous scene from Crocodile Dundee where he's in New York and they get accosted by a mugger, and the chap pulls out a knife and she says, "Give him your wallet, he's got a knife." He says, "No, that's not a knife." And the guy looks doubtful. Well, he says, "No, this is a knife." And he pulls out his 2-foot-long Australian hunting knife. And it's a bit like that, really. If you imagine walking into an Apple store or something, or meeting an Apple fan and say, "How are you getting with that iPhone 5 camera?" And they say, "Oh, yeah, it's really good, really good. I'm really enjoying it." And you say, "That's not a camera. This is a camera." And then you do this jaw-dropping 12 times lossless zoom trick on a distant object, and you bring it up full screen, and then jaws will drop, and that's a camera. And that's the line I shall leave you with this week. We could talk for hours, Rafe. It's been great chatting with you, but I think we'd better draw a line and say goodbye for now.
Yeah, and if you've got any complaints as an Apple user about still Steve trolling you in an Apple store, please send them to we're going to ignore you @allaboutsymbian.com. And thank you very much for listening.
See you next time. Bye.